Good morning and welcome to All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, and one thing I'm going to promise you at the top of the show, no politics. We're going to talk about books today and have a wonderful hour of escape with my guest, Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic and whose blog is The Longest Chapter, and Kevin Griffith, who is professor of poetry and creative writing at Capital University, who has a new book of poetry on the way that we'll talk about in just a moment. But we're going to start a new feature here on All Sides Weekend Book. At the top of every show, we're going to have a brief author interview. And today's debutante is the author Dennis Lehane, whose latest novel is called Live by Night. He's the author of Gone Baby Gone, Shutter Island, and Mystic River, among others. And I spoke to him on the phone yesterday from his home in Boston. Your new novel, Live by Night, deals with the end of Prohibition and goes into the Depression years. And you also, in the previous book, were talking about the Boston police strike of 1919. What makes a particular historical time interesting to you as a writer?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, the given day was interesting to me, the time period of that, because it was when the Boston police strike took place. So, I mean, I started the germ of the idea was always the Boston police strike. But then that led me into, as I was writing that book, thinking, oh, look how close I am to my favorite decade, which is the 1920s. And the reasons for why that's my favorite decade are as shallow as they had great clothes to maybe a little bit more interesting I guess it's the grandest failed social experiment in American history.
Well, Prohibition? Yeah.
Prohibition. Yeah. And so you look at a time in which the entire country turned its back on the rule of law, and we became a society of outlaws in some ways, and that must have just been so dizzying and exciting.
One of the things I also noticed about your work consistently is that if a reader has never set foot in any of the neighborhoods you write about, you immediately recognize them. You immediately become at home. You have a wonderful sense of place. Is that something you developed or is important? Are you aware of that?
I am, insofar as it's something that's that I'm place-centric in a lot of ways. I'm one of those people who can be quickly depressed living in a place I don't like. I'm not one of those people who could just live anywhere. I don't get those people who can. So that might have something to do with my psychology when it comes to place. So when I do write about place, it's usually a place that I'm enamored of in some way, you know, in some way, shape, or form. And then I try and put that onto the page. But then there have been plenty of times where I've written about places, not plenty of times, but a few times I've written about places that I've never been, that I thought, for whatever reason, sparked in my imagination and came out as vividly, I think, as I'd hoped. I'm thinking of Oklahoma in The Given Day, or the Pinar del Rio region of Cuba in Live by Night. Dialogue is the one thing I don't want to say born with, but it's the one thing I brought to the table when I decided to become a writer. And the reason I don't say born with it is because I grew up in a place where people spoke very vividly.
I know.
Yeah. Dorchester, I mean, Boston in general, and then you get into these sort of the inner city neighborhoods. People just speak they just speak very vividly. It's very pronounced dialect. And so by the time I started writing, as I began down this path, the one thing I could always do was write dialogue, because I'd heard so much great dialogue my entire life that, you know, walking out the door every day was like walking through a found poem. You know, it's funny, the very first kind of moment I remember having as a writer, a moment of revelation. The very first moment of revelation I remember having was connected to dialogue, and it was just standing on a subway platform one time, and I heard somebody say, "We're gonna do the polite PG version because that's not what he said." But he said, "The hell are you doing here?" And it just hit me in this moment. I think I was about 12. He didn't say what.
Mm.
He went right to, the hell you doing?
Right to the point, right in the guts, right, yeah, right.
Well,
there.
they cut out the what, and right. It just became, okay, that's suddenly a moment when you've just tuned your ear without knowing you did it. But I remember that was a great moment for me. I remember writing it in a notebook and just being like, wow, that's how people really speak here, not what you see in the books, you know?
That's part of my conversation yesterday with author Dennis Lehane. His new novel is Live by Night. And I guess I should start with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. How do we think about Dennis Lehane?
Well, I love Dennis Lehane. I've read, obviously, he's a very, he writes a page-turner, that's for sure. But I also respect him as a writer. I mean, he's taught in MFA programs, I know that. And I just think he combines the best of both worlds. He has that literary hand, and he also knows how to tell a great story. My personal favorite of Lehane's was Shutter Island, which I thought was a really engaging psychological drama, worked on many levels. Really liked the unreliable narrator in that, the shifting perception of reality. And, you know, it's not, and that's a sign that you're not just dealing with a throwaway thriller. And I think that's why he gets the respect that he does.
Good to know. We are welcoming your phone calls as well as we go on with this program at 292-8513. You can also go to allsides@wosu.org or find us on Facebook. Again, the number 292-8513. Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith come in here every time with stacks of books. And today, for the first time, they came in with the same book. It is called The Other by Thomas Tryon. That rang a bell. What is this?
Well, it was published in 1971. It is Thomas Tryon. That was Thomas Tryon's debut novel. And it hit the bestseller list and sold about 3.5 million copies. It's been reissued by the New York Review of Books Classic Series, and perfectly in this month because it is a very scary book. I was excited to see it being reprinted because when I read the book as a teenager, it did scare me to death. It also drew me into its darkness in a way that no other book had done before, and it twisted my mind. And I got to the end of it, and I thought, I need to reread this book, which I never did, but it's always lingered with me. So when I saw the reprint, I thought, this is my chance. It's a wonderful, complicated, involving story about two twins, Holland and Nigel.
Niles.
Mm-hmm. Holland and Niles Perry. Takes place in the 1930s in Connecticut on a farm. They are identical twins, one evil, one is good. And they are gathered with the family because their father has met an accidental death. And then there follow a series of just accidents on the farm, and people meet an untimely death, like falling on a pitchfork. Mm-hmm. And the local townspeople gets unsettled and scared, so does the family. And boy, Thomas Tryon just ramps mm-hmm. up the tension to the point where you're gripping the book.
Now, Thomas Tryon died at a young age, but Kevin, there's a backstory to him and his work.
Right. Well, first, I'd like to mention, too, that this has been reissued, and an afterword is written by Dan Shaun, our Ohio novelist who is on this show. Dan Shaun is, like, reevaluating its importance, mm-hmm. I think, in the pantheon mm-hmm. of literature, and it is. It's just a phenomenally good book. I was interested to see Tryon was a child actor, made his attempt in movies, was in a movie called The Cardinal, directed by Otto Preminger, and was so, I guess, verbally abused by Preminger that he decided to never act again. And of course, it's the young studly actor, the teen idol, decides to become a novelist, and everybody thought it was going to end up being just a joke, you know, that kind of thing. But it turned out that's where his real talent lay, I guess, because mm-hmm. This is like I said, if you're looking for a I wouldn't say it's intellectual, but it certainly does respect the reader and the reader's mm-hmm. sense of wanting more in a horror novel than just the usual stuff. I mean, this isn't just a gross over-the-top. This is a novel of the grotesque. It's an intellectual mm-hmm. novel. Talk about shifting narrators. It has one narrator who begins the story who's in a mental institution, and then the shifting perception between Holland and Niles is fascinating. The book does something incredible, too, is that what you think is the big payoff or the big shocking moment comes sort of midway in the book, and you think, what could he possibly do now to keep my attention? And it gets even more riveting mm-hmm. after that. I don't want to give anything away because the novel is so full of surprises. And the house that it's set in is just so creepily drawn. It's filled with little storerooms that house marionettes and old trunks, and it has a room in the basement of the hay barn where they play, and that's where their father was also killed. And it's just it works on just so many levels. It's just such a creepy novel. I would strongly recommend, even if you're not a fan of horror fiction, and I'm not necessarily, it's just such an engaging read.
I read on a website, because I was fascinated by that genre of horror fiction, and there is a Horror Writers of America website, and they write what about horror fiction. What is it? Because this is not a Freddy Krueger book.
Right.
And which is, that's how we consider what is horror now in the horror film. But back in the 70s, I mean, this was the kind of horror book that was written where it is psychologically engaging, it's creepy. And this was also the decade when Rosemary's Baby was written, and 1971 was when The Exorcist was released.
Yes, the high mark of that type of fiction.
And Shirley Jackson had just died, or she was just ending her career. She died unexpectedly as well, and she was another one who worked in short stories in that genre very much.
Well, she did novels, too.
Yes, she did.
She did
the Haunting of Hill House.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's right.
Correct. And it was that kind of horror novel, and as this, the other, that readers were engaging in, wanting not just the blood and the gore and the craziness. They wanted that literary engagement as well as the psychological, intellectual engagement.
Just that impending sense of dread that starts right on page one, and it just won't let you go throughout the novel. I strongly recommend it. It's just, especially from a creative writing teacher's standpoint, if you want to see how do you write a really engaging story without selling out, I think you should read the other. I think so.
And he kept with this, too. Thomas Tryon wrote another bestseller with Harvest Home, just as engaging and creepy.
Really? I'll have to read that one. I haven't had a chance. I was so excited by this one. But Now, is Harvest, maybe you know this, but is Harvest Home been re-released? Is that still in print? I'm baffled that this one went out of print and had to be re-released.
I'll tell you, Tom, when I saw the name Thomas Tryon and that novel, it did, as I said, ring bells with me, and I was hard put to place because I do remember now, back in the day, he was very popular. He was a bestseller, and he had a new book every 2 or 3 weeks. So, and then I guess there's a case of they go away. They're just a product of their time, and a generation has to go by until we really understand it again.
Which is why the New York Review of Books Classic Series is so wonderful. They keep bringing back books that are wonderful reads, engaging, great plot lines, wonderful characters, memorable, that have gone out of print simply because maybe it's past its era.
Well, we're going to talk more about horror novels. And you have also what you just told me, Kevin, is a great 2-day read, the 3-day affair, 3-day read, whatever. We talked about that briefly before, but let's touch on it again because that's a writer with a local connection.
Right. Well, kudos to Cassie for mentioning it on the last show. And I think and during the last show last month, you hadn't finished it yet, right? You were in the middle of it.
That is correct. Yeah.
And so my wife always runs to the library and gets everything you recommend. So
as
she brought it home.
As do I, yes.
She said it was just, she's not a big fan of noir or the usual macho masculine noir novel. And it is about three guys from Princeton who are getting back together again. And an incredible plot hook. They drive to a local 7-Eleven, and one of them, Jeffrey, who's having some financial trouble and lives on the West Coast, comes out with the clerk, dragging the clerk with him, who's a young girl, and just says, drive. And all of a sudden, they're involved in this tangled web of kidnapping, you know, robbery, the whole works. They're wondering, they go to an abandoned music studio. Well, I guess it's not abandoned, but an old music studio, and try to figure out what to do next.
And one of the guy is running for Congress, too.
Yeah,
so his reputation
and he's,
needs
of course,
to be
he's, of course,
protected.
Willing to do anything to hide
this. A little touch of politics there, but it's, I'll let that pass.
Right, okay.
But that he has a local connection. Michael Cardos is a product of a creative writing
MFA OSU. At OSU.
All right.
And he is also, he's a creative writing faculty member, I believe, at Mississippi State, I think it said in the back. So
his collection of short stories that came out before this book is also very good. And it's called One...
Let me figure it out
book.
Here.
It's very creative.
One Last Good Time.
One Last Good Time. Wonderful
by
characters.
Michael Cardos, an author with local... And that's a not-put-down book, The Three-Day Affair. We're going to be back in a few seconds. We're going to take a break. 292-8513, All Sides Weekend Books.
Support for 89.7 comes from St. Joseph Montessori School, educating the human potential of Central Ohio students, pre-K through 8th grade, for more than 40 years. The school will be hosting an open house October 28th between 3 and 5 p.m. More information at sjms.net. Inspire, explore, celebrate. And support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, helping families eliminate worry, reduce stress, and reestablish personal freedom. Serving Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care, to us, it's personal. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a fun and funny-paced look at the week's news. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Saturdays at 11 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News. Currently 54 degrees in Columbus, cloudy with a chance of showers overnight. Cool and rainy this weekend.
Thank you. That was our ever adorable producer today, Eric French. Thank you, Eric. Cassie Rose, Kevin Griffith, and I are here to talk about books, All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. Cassie, you have brought in Lillian Hellman's Pentimento, and there are people who see or hear that name and run screaming from the room. So let's touch a bit about, talk about an old book new again, Pentimento, Lillian Hellman.
I've always wanted to read this book because of the movie Julia. I saw it in a black and white on TV a long, long time ago, and I knew it came from Pentimento. And so I finally picked it up, and it was, I mean, this is her memoir that she wrote back in the 50s. So she was writing a memoir before memoirs became what they are today. It is written in, like, portraits from her life. And she has very, what we would say today, a dysfunctional family. So she's writing about her Uncle Willie, who takes her on a fishing trip out into the middle of Cajun country in Louisiana and has her living with a huge Cajun family for a weekend while he's, you know, with his sweetheart and his wife is back home. But it's through her, you know, 14, 15-year-old eyes. Or another portrait is about her cousin who comes over from Germany and ends up with a gangster, you know, in a small grocery holdout in New Orleans. So colorful stories, but it's her personality, her commentary. It's like she's dissing on people. And she's also, her own character is coming out of this colorful, wonderful person you want to sit down and talk with. Mm-hmm. Now, she's a very controversial character.
And Julia's a controversial story of that part of the book, isn't
yes.
it? Is it not?
Well, she was from a very, very wealthy family and was over in Austria in the 1930s when Hitler was coming to rise and working on the underground and working with the socialists. And she engaged Lillian Hellman in a drop-off that made the movie and also makes it a very compelling read for the book. So I find the memoir just what they say is unputdownable because it is so colorful and it feels like she's talking to you, that you're sitting with her over a cup of coffee or at her house and she's opening up about this life and you're amazed. I mean, in a way, Christopher, it's kind of like some of the stories you tell when you write about talk about the divas you've met or,
right, yeah.
or you know, who...
I married this idiot, you know.
Well, no, you talk about the opera stars. You know, we will be just walking down the hall, and you'll go, oh, yeah, Beverly Sills. You know, she came in. She, you know, 2 minutes before she was to go on at the Met, she had this fur coat. She threw it at me, told me to take care of it. I mean, it's that kind of stuff. You're like, oh, I want to hear more of that. Or, you know, the Anne Sexton, you know, and how
Anne
you were,
Sexton,
you know,
yes,
the class
yeah,
and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
so
the
it's,
class in the bar. Yeah.
But it's that kind of feeling that you get with this book. So if you want to read a memoir that's very colorful, you know, this, and you want to get to know Lillian Hellman, this is probably a good place to start.
That's also probably her best known non-play.
Non-play, correct.
Right. Her,
sure.
her plays, of course, are
The Children's Hour.
Children's Hour and the one with Regina, the Little Foxes.
The Little Foxes,
Foxes which
yes.
is the big hit. That's right.
Well, and her stories with Dashiell Hammett.
Right.
I mean, her life story with that a biography of her came out this year.
I have it, yeah, and it's mm-hmm. pretty, it's rough on her.
Is it?
Yeah, he's mm-hmm. not in love with her at all, but mm-hmm. I'm halfway through it. 292-8513 is the call. If you'd like to get in the conversation, let us know what you are reading. AllSides@WOSU.org is the web address. You can also find us on Facebook. And speaking of memoir, I just want to throw this out because we talked about it at the last program. It was the very hot new memoir, Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie. Have either of you read that or heard any buzz about it? You mentioned it, Cassie.
I decided not to read it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm here to tell you I didn't like it at all. I thought it was pretentious and boring and kind of selfish. It wasn't my cup of tea in the least. And I'm sorry. It's kind of non-PC to diss Salman Rushdie, but consider yourself dissed. I didn't like the book at all.
I'll tell you what.
I finished it. I mean, it's one of those books. I'm halfway through it. I don't like it, but I've invested 300 pages, and I'll be darned if I'm going to stop reading it. So I did finish the 675-page memoir. But
And here, I'll tell you what the sign to me was that turned me off is that I really wanted to read it. And then I thought, I'm going to go look at it at Barnes & Noble before I get a review copy or whatever. And I went and I saw it was written in the third person. And I thought, I don't think this is going to work. I mean, it can, I suppose, but it made me immediately think there's not going to be any soul in this. There isn't going to be any confession because third person, you know, pulls you so far distant from it that you aren't going to be writing with that heart and that soul that we want in memoirs.
You know, he survived a horrible time when they, mm-hmm. you know, they put a fatwa, a death sentence against him and lived in hiding for years. But there's no sense of catharsis. There's no mm-hmm. sense that he was at all changed by that, except that he was frankly resentful of being put in that position mm-hmm. because of a book he wrote, The Satanic Verses, that apparently offended half the world.
Right. Mm-hmm. And people people associated with him did get hurt.
Yeah,
right?
They did.
Yes,
some
like
were killed.
Yes.
Yeah, it was his Japanese translator.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And his wife, his former wife's house where his son lived was ransacked. And mm-hmm.
Did you get any sense, I just wondered, from reading that, why he would have chosen to do it in third person? Did he explain
I
that?
I don't know, but it was off-putting.
It seems an odd choice.
It was kind of phony.
It does. Like it,
but, anyway, that's my take mm-hmm. on Salman Rushdie's. I have not read any of his other books, so I'm in no position to comment, but that one I didn't care for. 292-8513, allsides@wosu.org. Call us and let us know what you're reading. What do you have there? You have a very colorful novel in front of me.
Well, this is great. This is all. It's just wonderful to sort of pick a novel at random. I've never heard of this writer, Antoine Wilson, but he's written one previous novel. And this new novel just came out. It's called Panorama City. And it's it's one of those things you just stumble upon, and it's turned out to be a fascinating read. It's the first-person narration of a character named Oppen Porter. And Oppen Porter is a 28-year-old, I guess you would say, he calls himself a slow absorber. He's been non-functional, okay, and he's been living with his father in Panorama City, and the whole city's just kind of gotten to know him and work with him and let him be who he is, ride his bike and do construction jobs here and there. But his father dies, and his really controlling aunt comes in to take custody of him and takes him to a larger city, a bigger city, and forces him to like attend meetings with a mentor, and he has to also work at a fast food restaurant, hold down a 9-to-5 job, and he approaches it with just this sort of sense of joie de vivre and positive thinking, and the whole novel is just it's very charming, and he makes really great observations on life, like he says. I began to think that God was always testing everyone over and over again. God took time out of his busy schedule for earthquakes and athletic contests and glorious sunsets. Such thinking seems absurd to me now. It seems preposterous in about 5 different ways, but at that moment, it was very real. You will no doubt go through a period in life when you believe you are the center of everything. It is an interesting period to go through. It's good for the development of one's thinking, but it is also one of the most important periods to come out of. Okay, he's a very thoughtful kind of savant, I guess I would say. And he runs into a con man, and the con man convinces him to let him live in the attic of his aunt's house, which leads to all sorts of problems. And it's just a wonderful novel. It's not very plotty whatsoever, but the voice will charm you so much. And you'll learn a lot just about, think of life in a different way. And isn't that what a novel's supposed to do?
Antoine Wilson.
It's called Panorama City. Antoine Wilson, just a great find. And I strongly recommend you read it if you're looking for something that'll lift your spirits a little bit.
And one of the many things I love about Kevin is that when he comes in, all the books come from the library. They're all seriously, that's a great thing. They all come from the Columbus Public Library, so they are there to be read. So go patronize the libraries. But I want to talk about your blog for a minute, Cassie, The Longest Chapter. I want to, what's current on your blog right now? What are the latest couple of things you've been writing about?
I just did write about the other, but before that, I did something a little different. I had met with a book group that was needing to select a book. This was the group that won Time with Me with Chefs in the City during that auction.
Yes, of course.
So I meet with a group of representatives and I take a stack of books and that they choose it. So I shared their decision process on the blog. I said, here were the six books that I took, and I said why that I selected those books and gave a summary, and then I gave their verdict of why they decided not to read it or what to do with it. For example, I took two classics, and one of them was the new translation of Madame Bovary by Lydia Davis. And it was that specific to say that it had to be that translation. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did take two classics is because the list I had gotten from them of what they had read was, it was all over the map for what they read. So you can take classics as a really good default in case someone wants to get something off their bucket list, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, I also took Truman Capote's In Cold Blood.
Oh, no kidding, yeah.
Because a lot of people have not read it. Well, one of the representatives, she could not go there. She couldn't, it disturbed her too much, the thought of someone walking into a house that with the door unlocked. And she was adamant. And so that was the reason why they didn't choose that book.
Oh.
So
it's a horrible story, but it's brilliantly told.
Yeah, it's great, right?
Yes, yeah. So that was, and that was the one before that. I can't really remember. I think I have some young adult books on there, and I have some other new books. But
so you're doing Madame Bovary, the Lydia Davis translation, then?
No, they chose Sacred Hunger by Barry Unsworth.
Oh, yeah.
They decided it was too depressing.
Madame Bovary,
which it is.
Yeah,
it is.
But one,
that's why we love it. You know.
Right. Well, you know what? On the inside flap, I love the first line where it described it. You know, Madame Bovary is the first desperate housewife.
Yeah. Oh,
and
there
I thought that was a classic. That's a classic line. Yeah.
Resonate right there.
Right.
What did Flaubert himself say, though? He said, you know, all happy families are the same, but each unhappy family is different in its own way, and that's what you're supposed to be writing about.
We're all miserable. That's why God created drugs. Anyway, Kevin Griffith, what you have a new book coming out that you wrote.
Oh, yeah,
let's
that's
talk
exciting.
About that. It is exciting.
Well, this is kind of exciting for me. It's great. About a year ago, signed a contract with a little press, a new press in California called Folded Word Press, and they're like these presses are rising now. They're on the up because of ebooks and everything else and all the collaboration going on in the publishing industry and all that. But Folded Word is a boutique press. They publish fine quality handmade books, and they also, what they do is they'll put the full length version as ebooks on Amazon. So my book is called 101 Kinds of Irony. And this is very hot now, at least in the literary circles, is that it's a book that doesn't fit into any genre category. It's not quite poetry. It's not quite short stories. It's not quite a joke book. They described it as a collection of microfiction, and microfiction meaning short stories that are fewer than 100 words. And the book basically starts defines all the various types of ironies, dramatic irony, right? Cosmic irony, okay? Mm-hmm. Paradoxical irony. And then it just keeps getting more and more absurd. For instance, it'll have like Wheeling, West Virginia irony and Schrodinger's irony. And my philosophy now with books is this: if it ain't fun, I'm not doing it. And I had a lot of fun writing it. And it's a fun read. It's not Dennis Lehane, that's for sure, but it's just sort of a fun, light read. And if you're looking for something that'll just distract you during the day and give you a few laughs, I would recommend it. It's called 101 Kinds of Irony. You can get it on Amazon as an ebook. It's $2.99, and then they're publishing just 50 fine print editions that have hand sewn binding and parchment quality paper cover. And of course, Christopher and Cassie will be getting one of those.
Thank you. Nice.
and several other lucky people.
But
I think that's fantastic because there's so much going on at little presses, and they're really sort of saving the day and just buy the ebook so you can support that kind of art form, mm-hmm. people who still appreciate the book.
And with ebook, it makes it easy to go for quantity and quality. So
That's right. You have an infinite number of ebooks available.
And the price is always very low compared mm-hmm. to buying the hardcover mm-hmm. book. Mm-hmm. Also, I wanted to throw one thing out because there's a current book I want to ask you about. But I told you before that I read a semester, as it were, 10 pages a day. And I'm almost at the end of Moby Dick.
Oh boy.
Didn't like it, okay? I've learned everything I could learn about whales and blubber in my entire mm-hmm. life if I never see a whale again. But have you ever done that? Have you taken, or anybody out there, call us and let us know if you ever taken a big classic and said, I can read this 10 pages a day or 5 pages a day and do it. Have you ever done that, Cassie?
Yes, I've done it. And it's a great way to get through a classic that maybe you have missed. Mm-hmm. And although sometimes I will get halfway through it and then I put it aside and then a couple months go by and then I pick it up again because some of these classics are huge. And also, it's talking about a book during its era. Yeah. I mean, Melville was writing during a time when that kind of description, that kind of detail,
was never done, right? Yeah.
It was, I mean, but it was published. It was, people were used to it. They also had more time to read. And reading was part of the entertainment. Families would gather around at night and read books mm-hmm. together. There was no TV set. There was no radio. So that's why that kind of book was popular, and it doesn't work as much now.
Having heard you say that, I am now humbled and chastised for what I said earlier.
Well, no. It's hot, but I agree with you because I think it's hard to get through because nowadays we don't have the time to read and we don't have the patience with it either. Mm-hmm. But also, Moby Dick is hard to read on your own. I think it works better when you're in a class and there is discussion about the themes and mm-hmm. and the character development and what's going on. That's why I appreciated reading so many of the classics during my university years, because that helped so much.
You have to be forced, right?
Right, but you also have the professor mm-hmm. coming in and tying things together for you. We're talking mm-hmm. about the significant moments mm-hmm. and relating it to life. And I mean, I can remember Clockwork Orange and all the things that my professor said about it, which was not just about the book, but it interpreted life in a way for me.
Well, I'd like to know if anybody's reading something 10 pages at a time and how you're doing. 292-8513, allsides@wosu.org, or you can find us on Facebook. We're going to take a quick break now. We'll be back shortly with more of All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. I'm Christopher Purdy.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888.
I can speed up and slow down the modulation.
On the next Fresh Air from the Archive, an interview with the late Robert Moog. A festival of electronic and visionary music in tribute to him takes place this weekend. Also from the Archive, an interview with John Cage. His work is the subject of international celebrations this year, marking the centennial of his birth. Join us.
Stay with us for Fresh Air at noon, right here on 89.7 NPR News. Your WOSU Public Media member card benefits are even better with the Member Card Benefit of the Month. The benefit of the month for October is the Columbus Jazz Orchestra and the Jazz Arts Group. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long, subject to availability. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org.
I'm Christopher Purdy. We are back for our last segment of All Sides Weekend Books. And the want here, the calls are now coming in fast in our last 20 minutes. So God love you all. We'll get to you as soon as we can. Cassie, I was talking about Moby Dick, which I understand, I get, I love, I admire. But you had a point about a new edition of it or a more recent edition of it.
Well, there is an author named Matt Kish who set himself the task of doing one illustration a day for a year from Moby Dick. So he was doing this on his own. So he was reading the book and doing the illustration again, completing one a day, putting himself under this strenuous schedule just for himself to accomplish something. Publishers picked it up, and it ended up being a beautifully published book that is available in hardcover and in softcover. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking for you, Christopher, now that you have read Moby Dick, you will be able to go to this book and it will sing to you, mm-hmm. because you will know the story. You can look at the beautiful illustrations and read the quotes.
It's my own fault for choosing a cheap, crummy edition. That's mm-hmm. that's my own fault. But I will do it. I will do as mm-hmm. you suggested, Cassie Rose. Thank
but that
you.
Is also a good point, too, because that's why I recommend that with the Madame Bovary, that if we were going to read it with a club, they had to read the Lydia Davis translation. The mm-hmm. editions of books make a difference when it's a classic or a translation.
That's right. We've been asking people what they might be reading 10 pages at a time, what big, thick classic or whatever book that might be difficult to get into in one chunk, and we're getting some calls. If you'd like to call and join that conversation or talk about books in any form, 292-8513, all sides at WOSU.org. We have Brad from Columbus. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I have to correct, quote, all happy families are alike. That's Tolstoy, the first line in Anna Karenina. I'm a big Tolstoy fan, and I couldn't let that go.
Right. And you stump the chump, then.
I'm reading War and Peace, and it's sort of hard to get through, especially the weight of the book, but it's a wonderful novel.
But and which edition are you reading? Are you reading the Pavensky or what they're called?
The couple. I'm not sure what their name is. Yeah, it's a great edition.
So you
and a great translation.
Right. You have the original French, though. In other words, right?
I mean,
War and Peace, he's talking about.
War and Peace, yeah. Well, that's what I mean.
It's published in French, yeah.
Well, no, it's just that there's a lot of dialogue among
French,
the Russians in French.
Oh, yeah, a lot of dialogue.
Right, and they maintain the French there, and then you have to translate.
Right, I'm a French teacher, so I get through that okay.
Brad, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. All Sides Weekend Books, we're talking about what you're reading now a little bit at a time or more, and we have a call from Sarah in Columbus, so I think she's reading a great favorite of mine. I'll let her tell you. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Good morning. It's ironic that the last caller said mentioned a line from Anna Karenina, because I'm actually not reading this now, but last winter I read Anna Karenina, and I had intended to only read it a few pages at a time, as you're talking about, because some friends of mine were reading it for their Russian lit class. I said, oh, I'll read it with you. And I ended up finishing the book long before they ever did, because I got so carried up in the story, and I wasn't even taking their class. And it was one of those things where I really had intended to only read it a bit by bit, but found it so engrossing that it just carried me away.
That's terrific. Thank you for telling us. So you really loved Anna Karenina, right? You found it was hard to put down?
I really did. I sort of didn't expect to find, you know, a big sweeping Russian novel that was going to be so just captivating. But it really was, you know, just a very lovely story.
Well, Sarah, thank you very much. I'm glad to hear you liked it. Thank you.
Thanks.
All Sides Weekend Books, 292-8513. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. If you'd like to let us know what you're reading, people are also asking about Moby Dick or yelling at me about Moby Dick, maybe. Who knows about that? We have a call from Malcolm in Columbus. Hi, Malcolm.
Hi. I have a book that I read recently that I heard about on some NPR show that I don't even remember what it was, but it's called Sudden Noises from Inanimate Objects. It's by Christopher Miller. And what makes it so hilarious is that the whole format is liner notes to a CD collection of the complete works of an extremely eccentric composer written by an extremely eccentric biographer.
Oh, I'm writing this down. That sounds great.
Oh, exactly. Christopher, you would love it. It's hilarious.
Sudden Noises from Inanimate Objects, is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
A novel, yeah, and the subtitle is A Novel in Liner Notes.
Malcolm, thanks so much for the recommendation. We appreciate it. We always like funny or offbeat or different on this program, since that's what we are anyway as people. 292-8513. What one classic, each of you, is something that you would read again and again, Cassie or Kevin or both?
You can go ahead.
Well, you know, if any of my students are listening out there, you have to have Infinite Jest read by Monday. I would say that's a classic now, and they're probably reading it 10 pages at a time, or they
David
have
Foster
been.
Wallace.
Yeah, David Foster Wallace's right. Infinite Jest. So I've read that at least 3 times now, so that would be one.
How about you, Cassie?
Boy, I don't have one that comes to mind right away. So I'll have to think on that for
Anna
a moment.
Anna Karenina would be mine, probably.
I loved Anna Karenina.
And I've said this ad nauseum, a confederacy of dunces, because that is me, you know. Well, we have a call. We have more calls. Ula from Delaware wants to talk about Moby Dick. Hi there.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry to pick on you, but really, Moby Dick is not about whales and blubber.
Well, I didn't think it was, but it does mention it a lot. But go ahead.
I just wanted to say, please don't insult our readers. Anyway, you know, it's about America and America's racism and American history and America's destructiveness. It's a very important book. It tells us. Obviously, I'm an English professor, you know.
That's what I was thinking. Good.
It does tell us early on the things we're doing wrong.
Oh, so what a good perspective. Now, thank you for that.
Well, may I say something else?
Sure.
A book you must read is The God of Small Things.
Everybody's...
A rundown.
Yeah, yes.
The God of Small Things. It shall become a classic. It won the Booker Prize. It was the first novel by a young woman, a young person, an Indian woman, and she's just amazing. Her tone, everything. Please, everyone run out there to the library. Get The God of Small Things. I can't remember her name.
Okay, The God of Small Things. Thank you so much for that tip. I will do that. I will go out and get it.
Please.
Okay, thank you so much for your call.
Bye-bye.
All Sides Weekend Books, whether or not you like Moby Dick, and yes, I know it's about American history and admire it a lot. It was just kind of a slow read for me, but it's something everybody should read. There you go. David Foster Wallace is somebody you talk about a lot, Kevin, who recently died. He's a contemporary writer, a little bit off the beaten path. I got the Infinite Jest from the library, and it's only a 2-week book, and it's 1,100 pages.
That's
so
correct.
I've kind of given up. I can't do it in 2 weeks. But tell me, what about David Foster Wallace is so unique?
Well, I think that when we talked about the 10-page-at-a-time book that you wait till the summer to read, I think that's one of them, because I notice it always disappears during the summer and has a really long waiting list. I guess I would make a segue from Infinite Jest into the recent biography of David Foster Wallace, which has just come out by D.T. Max. It's called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. And even if you haven't read Infinite Jest, or you're not going to quite go there yet, because it is a challenge, and it's one of those books, like Cassie says, it's probably better to have someone leading you through it and forcing you to do it. I think you should read every love story is a ghost story, because Infinite Jest, for all its postmodern veneer, is really just the story of his life. I mean, a very sad story. David Foster Wallace suffered many forms of addiction, alcohol addiction, and those parts of the book which deal with recovery programs and AA, the Ennett House in Boston, that's his life. He was... ironically, addicted to recovery groups, and everywhere he went, he found a recovery group, and most of his friends were his fellow AAers who helped him out a lot. And if you're a writer, I think, or if you have pretensions of being a novelist or writer, you ought to read this book and his struggles, and read about his struggles in graduate school, and also his struggles to get people to take Infinite Jest seriously. he made, this is unbelievable, but his take or his advance for Infinite Jest was by the time everything was taken out, the taxes and the agent's fees, a mere $5,000. That's what it was. He was hoping to make a living as a writer, and you can't do it if you're a serious novelist.
And also, I don't think by the time of his death, he was wealthy from his writing, from accrued royalties
at all. His dream was to not have to teach, even though he was a very good teacher. And if you're a teacher, you should read this as well, about how much effort he put into his classes. But no, he was never able to reach that dream. He could have if he, like Jay McInerney, who was a friend of his, he could have, but he says, you know, to be a writer and to make a living as a writer, you have to constantly maintain the statue of yourself that the media has created. And McInerney could do that. And
it's hard.
Yes. Bret Easton Ellis could do that, but he didn't want to do that. And therefore, he really was never a wealthy man. And taught all of his life up to the time of his death. He taught at Pomona College. He died when he was 46. Yeah, he was a teacher at Pomona College. It's every love story is a ghost story. It's very tightly written. It's not Joseph Anton, that's for sure. It's very tightly written. D.T. Max is a good writer. And even if you know nothing about David Foster Wallace or have never read anything by him, I would recommend it just to read the story of a great writer's life.
I've sat here and I've said that I don't like two different rather important books. So I'm going to just, here's a book I loved. This Is How You Lose Her by Junot Diaz. It is a new collection of short stories. It is incredible. It made me go back and read his first collection, which is called Drown, and his novel, The Lost Something of Oscar Wilde. Junot Diaz just won the MacArthur Grant, Genius Grant. Have you read this latest collection?
I read Drown, but I want to pick up this, which has just been
tremendous.
Shortlisted for the National Book Award.
Yeah, highly recommended. Mark is on the line, and Mark wants to talk about sci-fi. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you guys doing today?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. I'm listening to you guys, and you guys are talking about a lot of classic books, and that's great. One thing that I haven't really heard you talk about is sci-fi. Now, I'm a huge sci-fi fan, and I've been working through right now Frank Herbert's Dune. Are you guys familiar with this series?
Of course.
Oh, my God. Now, this is one thing that, for me, as a younger student, reading this, it's very thick, it's very involved, and there's a lot of books in the series. And for me, I feel like it just doesn't get enough recognition among a lot of readers.
Hank, just say it again, just more clearly.
Frank Herbert's Dune.
Dune, okay.
Yeah,
okay,
Dune.
I'm sorry. Yeah, there you
me.
Go. Yeah, that's
Excuse
fine.
Me.
Good.
Yeah, Dune. But it's reflective. He wrote it at a time, where the American military was, going through the Red Scare, we were facing off against Russia and, communist nations. And that's what he bases his stories about. And then his son took that over. And for me, I read it at a time that was very tumultuous for me. And the things that he writes are actually very deep and really, really influential. And he writes about self-defense and personal exploration. And I really, it's sci-fi, but it is a book that I would recommend to anyone, going through a tumultuous time. Because you do learn a lot. You explore yourself as you explore Frank Herbert's Dune universe.
Mark, thanks so much, and I'm glad you called in and brought up sci-fi, because we should do a little more with that, and I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Hey.
We have a call from Sally in Columbus, who has a funny story about Moby Dick. Okay, if you dare, Sally. Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I hardly dare, but I did read Moby Dick many years ago, but sometime along the way, I read somewhere that a professor had, at the end of term exam, had one question, and it was to discuss the relevance of the sea in Moby Dick. So one student takes about 15 seconds and turns his paper in, and the professor, of course, is astounded that it goes to read it, and it says, all it says is, where else would you place a novel about a whale?
You got to love that guy.
Yes, I thought that was really funny, and it reduced it to something I don't know.
And
what.
He probably didn't pass the course, though, unfortunately. But
I think it's a really brilliant answer.
I do, too. Thank you, Sally, so much. Thank you for that. Thank you. We have a few minutes left. I'm Christopher Purdy, your host for All Sides Weekend Books today with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. Cassie Rose's blog is The Longest Chapter. Kevin Griffith is a professor at Capital University, and your new book that is coming out?
101 Kinds of Irony.
And you can get it?
At Amazon. Just go to Amazon.
It's an e-book.
Mm-hmm.
An e-book, $2.99. So I want a lot of volume there. I want a lot of calls to Amazon before we end the hours. If you, we can take a few more calls if you have a book you want us to read or you want to recommend. And Theo is on the line from Dayton. Hi, Theo.
Yes, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Yes, again, it's not so much about what I'm reading at this time, but rather what I'm writing. Currently, I'm in the process of finishing up the last leg of a very provocative book that I'm writing. It's called Belief is Stronger Than Reality, Bible Analysis and the Study of Diabolical Demonology.
Hmm.
And this book deals with a lot of false religious concepts that people have about religious spirituality, and it transverses over into the occult. Actually, this book picks up somewhat in the area of where Dan Brown touched upon
the Da Vinci Code,
concepts of religion of Jesus and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, just kind of wanted to put that out there. It's coming. It's going to make a lot of people angry, I'm sure, and it's going to make a lot of people, in some regards, happy. Because a lot of people are really thirsty for this type of knowledge. And
controversy is good for discussion. Thank you very much for your call, Theo. I appreciate that. 292-8513. You can send an email quickly to allsides@wosu.org. What about nonfiction? Is there anything nonfiction that has leapt out at either of you recently, Kevin?
Yeah, I brought one in. This was on the recommended bookshelf at the Whetstone Library multiple times. It's called A First-Rate Madness. By Nasir Gahimi. It's called Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness. And it is the most fascinating book I have ever read. And his main thesis, and he is a professor of psychology at Tufts, his main thesis is that people who are manic depressives make better leaders, better world leaders. And he compares, for instance, Winston Churchill with Neville Chamberlain, and says Neville Chamberlain was your sort of button down, middle of the road guy, and look what he did. He trusted Hitler, and Winston Churchill knew how his basic argument is that people who have reached the bottom are depressives. Have also learned to see reality in a different way and to not give up and give in. And I think it's great. He looks at Churchill. He looks at John F. Kennedy, of course. And Kennedy had multiple addictions, prescription pills. He looks at Kennedy, Clinton, for instance. He looks at the current race with Obama and Romney. He talks about Romney a little bit and suggests that neither of them would be fantastic leaders because they're both sort of mentally stable individuals. It's called A First-Rate Madness. I found it just really engaging, and its topic very provocative. I thought that was fascinating. If you're looking for a book on leadership, or you're just interested in how people perceive the world and why they do and what makes a good leader, I'd recommend it.
I have a couple biographies that are on my radar screen. One of them is, and it's been out for a year, but it is the biography of Catherine the Great.
And Robert Massey's book? Yeah.
Yes, it came out in paperback this season, so I've got that on my reading table. And I also just learned there's a biography of Madeleine L'Engle coming out.
Oh.
It's coming out in November, which I've got my eyes on.
I thank everybody who called. I'm sorry there are calls waiting we can't get to. I appreciate the calls, and I always appreciate Cassie Rose, whose blog is The Longest Chapter. She is our book critic, and Kevin Griffith, professor at Capital University and author of a new book you can get from Amazon. One more time, real fast, title.
101 Kinds of Irony.
And thank Eric French, who was at the controls today, making us all legit. And thank you very much, Corinne Gleckler, Katie Higgins, Amy Corriton. Thanks for your help. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org.